be autonomy supportive. And so what that means is to provide kind of just enough support so that your child can do it on their own.
Hello, my dear friend. Welcome back to another episode of the Curious Neuron Podcast. My name is Cindy Hovington and I am your host. If you are new here, welcome. I'm a mom of three from Montreal, Canada, and I have a PhD in neuroscience. I'm here to share some insights with you that I pull out of neuroscience research or leadership skill research and psychology research, whatever I could find, some books that I'm reading. But most of all, I love finding some researchers, clinicians, or experts out there that will help us understand a certain topic even more. And that's what today's guest is all about. Dr. Stephanie Carlson has an amazing TED Talk that I want to share with you. I will put the link in the show notes. It's called Executive Function Skills Are the Roots of Success. And she is right. When I started going over all her work and digging back into the research around executive functions, I realized that we had covered this very lightly a few years ago and that we needed to dive right back into executive functions. There's so much around this that we need to talk about. Still some misconceptions and misunderstandings, I think, as parents. And sometimes we get stuck in these scenarios where our kids are doing something, for example, struggling to follow routines or plan something or problem solve through something or get out of an emotion. And we see it as their fault or we see it as their personality when in essence, it's something that we need to work on with them and that we need to support. So as their coach or their leader, we need to kind of give them that guidance, that scaffolding that Stephanie and I are going to talk about. And that's why I think it's important for us to cover this topic, because I know that by the end of it, you'll have some notes written down and you'll be able to say, oh, that's what I need to work on with my child. Or that's what I'm hoping, at least. I do want to take a moment to thank the Tannenbaum Open Science Institute here at the Neuro in Montreal for supporting the Curious Neuron podcast, as well as the McConnell Foundation. Without these two organizations, this podcast would not be possible. So thank you. This podcast would not be possible without you, the listener. So please, if you haven't done so, make sure you have clicked on the subscribe button, because that allows the platform that you're listening to this podcast on to know that this podcast matters to you. And I hope it does. So please press that. And if you haven't done so yet, click on rate the place where you have to go. I don't know where it is, wherever you're listening to it, to rate the podcast and to review the podcast. If anything, just at least rate it on 5 stars. And if you have a little extra time this week, take a moment to leave a review. It could be short, just write great if you want to, or not great, whatever you want to write. It would be really helpful, because those reviews and those ratings, as well as your following and downloading the podcast, all lead to me getting some funding that allow me to help get people to edit the podcast, the audio, the video, and create these little clips for you. So that it really is important. It doesn't come to me. It comes to them to help me support you and create more of these podcasts, which, by the way, are my favorite. I love this podcast so much and having these conversations with people. So please take a moment to do that. If you are interested in learning more about executive function skills, I do invite you to check the links in the show note. I will obviously put Dr. Carlson's TED Talk, as well as some links to her work. But in addition to that, I want to share an article called Metacognitive Processes and Associations to Executive Function and Motivation During a Problem-Solving Task in 3 to 5-year-olds. The reason why I'm doing that is because there are so many other cognitive abilities that we need to talk about. And this is one that links to part of what we talked about in the episode today, which is motivation. We often, I've heard this from parents who have kids in school, where sometimes their child isn't motivated and the parents don't know what to do. Dr. Carlson's going to give you a really important a piece of advice around that. And this article is going to support that and talk about metacognition, which is something else that I believe we should know about as parents. And I'm going to have to dig into that. But this article, in essence, highlights that metacognitive knowledge predicted executive function and metacognitive skills predicted motivation. So they're all interconnected and they're all things that we need to know about as parents, because they are developed in early childhood. And it's not only when kids are in school or preschool, it has a lot to do with when they're home with us. And as we'll learn with Dr. Carlson today, is we have a role in how we build the baby steps towards, building these skills, or as we say, scaffolding. So it really is important for us to know this. One other thing that we're going to talk about with Dr. Carlson is about sleep. And that's another important one and the impact that this has on your child's executive function skills. And I do want you to reflect on that for one moment by the end of the episode and think of the quality of sleep that your child is having and whether or not this might be having an impact on their cognitive abilities, such as executive function skills, because this does impact their level of focus and how they're performing at school as well. So today's or this week's reflection prompt that I'd like to pull out of this episode has to do with the quality of sleep that your child is getting. And the question that we are asking ourselves has nothing to do with the total number of hours of sleep. It has to do with how long they stay asleep, how many hours, right? And that applies to our quality of sleep as well. Even if you're sleeping 8 hours a night, but you're not consistently going to bed at the same time, or you're waking up several times a night, that is not quality sleep. And we're going to dig into that with Dr. Carlson. So let's not wait any longer. Stephanie M. Carlson has a PhD, and she is a distinguished McKnight University professor in the Institute of Child Development at the University of Minnesota. She investigates basic developmental processes in executive function, so brain basis of self-control in children from infancy through adolescence, with a focus on the preschool period. She's particularly interested in how executive function skills can be cultivated through play, parenting, and education, and in turn, how these skills prepare children for learning and better physical and mental health. Together with Professor Philip David Zelazo, she developed a brief direct measure of executive function skills appropriate starting at 24 months of age and extending through adulthood, called the Minnesota Executive Function Scale, MEFS. She co-founded Reflection Sciences for Kids and Reflective Performance for Adults to provide assessment and solutions for improving these important neurocognitive skills. Dr. Carlson is currently conducting a fully online research study examining the predictors of career interests in children, as executive functions might be one overlooked predictor of the topics and jobs students are drawn to in high school and beyond. To be eligible for this study, you must live in the United States and your child must be in fourth or eighth grade in the 2023-24 school year. Families will be contacted each year for 4 years. So if you are interested in this study, there's compensation as well, and it depends on the level of participation, but it ranges between $10 to $50. And I will put the link up in the show notes because it's really important to participate in research. All right, let's not keep you waiting. Please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Stephanie Carlson. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Curious Neuron Podcast. I'm here with our special guest today, Dr. Stephanie Carlson. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome.
Hi, Cindy. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being here. You know, I was reading through your articles, which led me to your TEDx talk, which I went down the rabbit hole one night and just was loving everything that I was reading. And I kept thinking about parents and struggles that they mentioned to me in terms of their child and what they're seeing in terms of, you know, whether it's delayed gratification or flexibility or emotions. And I just kept thinking of your research, thinking that they truly need to hear what you're doing in terms of your research. And I think it's important for them to know that. So we're going to cover not just kids today, but I also was thinking about parents themselves. And I want us to kind of talk about executive functions as a whole, but also, you know, go into the parenthood section where we can understand how it might be impacting our lives. Because I do think that sometimes parents are struggling with certain aspects of parenting or functioning or performance at work or at home, and we don't think about executive functions enough. So let's begin with the basics. I always want to make sure that everybody's on the same page. What are executive functions?
Well, executive function skills are neurocognitive or brain-based skills that we use to basically set and achieve goals. So these include being able to pay attention, being able to hold goals in mind, or kind of like hold information in mind, being able to resist distractions and reactions, and being able to think flexibly, being able to try solving a problem in a new way, or seeing something from someone else's perspective. These are all executive function skills, and they include self-regulation skills that we would use both in kind of neutral situations, like just, you know, learning a new math problem, or learning a new way to get to work or to get home if there is construction, but also in affectively or emotionally charged situations. So when a child steals your favorite toy, or when a coworker criticizes you. So we use these executive function skills in daily life in both kind of affectively neutral or what we call kind of cool situations, as well as more hot or emotional situations.
I'm sure that a parent that just heard this definition said or thought, all right, so this clearly doesn't develop in childhood, right? Like we probably think that this starts later on, maybe in teenage years or even later, because everything that you just described are the skills that parents struggle with their own child. Is this a skill that develops young at a young age?
Well, yeah, it's true that executive function skills are most conspicuous in their absence.
Right.
So when you think of a typical young child, it's someone who doesn't remember what their goals mm-hmm. are from one moment to the next. They're impulsive, they're emotional, they throw tantrums, and they get easily distracted. Mm-hmm. So we notice that, and it's frustrating as a caregiver sometimes to deal with those skills. And so you might be tempted to think that they have no executive function. But in fact, one of the real hallmarks of the last couple of decades of research is that we've been able to show through new measures that kids as young as 24 months have some executive function skills, and even younger. If you start to look at kind of the ways that children, even infants, self-soothe, even young infants will turn away from a stimulus that's annoying them or bothering them, and that's a way of kind of self-regulating and managing themselves in that moment. And so sometimes it's tempting to think about it as like a glass half empty. But if you know what to look for and what to expect when in development, you actually see these skills are kind of impressive, even in young kids.
You mentioned that delayed gratification, or we think of like the impulsivity piece. That is something that I think is the most common question that I receive from parents where, I talk a lot about emotion regulation skills, and that is part of it. And they don't often think about that being connected. So executive functions are part of these emotion regulation skills that we talk about, right? What is the role of EF skills in emotions and social emotional learning?
Yeah, so executive function skills are kind of the cognitive piece that is really mm-hmm. essential. And I view executive function skills as sort of the foundation that makes the cultivation and growth of social and emotional skills possible in the first place. Mm-hmm. We couldn't get there with social and emotional skills without these basic neurocognitive skills of executive function. So it's being able to hold goals in mind, resist impulses, and think flexibly that enables kids to develop routines that are less selfish. mm-hmm. behaviors that are less self-serving and selfish. Right. Being pro-social, sharing, sharing limited resources, showing kindness, even when it doesn't reward you in any direct way. Mm-hmm. Being able to be compassionate toward others. Being able to think about the group rather than just oneself. So all of those social emotional skills at some level require self-restraint. And kids need executive function skills to be able to do that.
I think of the marshmallow test, which you worked with that main researcher, I think, before he passed, right? From what I understood from your TEDx talk?
Yes, Walter Mischel.
Right. And so why did you redo the marshmallow test to see if it was still applicable with kids today?
Yeah, so that's one of the really fascinating findings that I wanted to leave your audience with, mm-hmm. because a lot of people might not know about that. Again, maybe tending to sort of underestimate kids. We mm-hmm. actually found that kids today delay gratification significantly longer than they did 50 years ago. And we didn't set out to kind of answer that question, but I had accumulated all of these data on the delay of gratification task or the marshmallow test in preschool children for several years. And Walter Michelle was a great mentor to me. And I said, you know, I have all these data. And parents always say to me about how they are sure that their kids would delay gratification, you know, less long, that they would be more impulsive than they themselves would have been as a child or than kids used to be. So we decided to put it to the test and compare his data from the 1960s and another data set of his from the 1980s with Professor Larry Aber. And we found that for each 20 years, there was an increased average delay of 1 minute on the on the marshmallow test. So
I love this finding so much because I agree with you. I think that as parents, our instinct is to say, well, I was able to wait. You know, like my parents made sure that I waited. And kids these days, you know, they're just impatient and impulsive. But I love that finding so much because it does remind us, you know, sometimes I think that our expectations for our kids are a little bit bigger. You know, I see this with concentration skills or the ability to focus. A lot of parents will say, you know, I just want my 2-year-old to wait 20, 30 minutes while I have a meeting. You know, during the pandemic, it was really difficult. And I would say, well, that's not necessarily developmentally appropriate at that age. It might not. Their child might be able to, but odds are they might not. So do you see the same thing with executive functions or especially the impulsivity aspect that we have like, bigger expectations for our kids?
For sure. And just because we see an average increase in delay of gratification over the last 50 years, it doesn't mean that young children don't still struggle. We see clear developmental trajectories on things like delay of gratification. You know, a toddler can wait about less than a minute for something, whereas an older child can, you know, start to wait much longer periods of time for gratification. I mean, a high schooler can now start to wait years in for a better long-term outcome, right?
Right.
And that's kind of what the marshmallow test is all about, is you'll have a better long-term outcome if you wait, you know, if you just don't take that marshmallow right now. So we see clear developmental change in that, but also in these like cooler executive function skills or problem-solving skills. So very young children can only hold about one thing in mind at a time. And they can't get unstuck off of that one thing easily. And you see this, you know, with a lot of tantrums with young children. It kind of starts because they are stuck on an idea.
Right. And they want that one red cup.
Yeah. And it's very hard to get unstuck and they get easily frustrated. So the older children can hold a few things in mind. Elementary age kids can hold a few things in mind and start to flexibly switch between them. Like, oh, I could look at it this way, or I could look at this exact same thing in a different light. And then, you know, secondary or high school age students are able to do that, but now much more efficiently. And we measure that through like reaction time. So those skills get just sort of faster and faster and more efficient, peaking at around age 25, and then unfortunately declining on average.
So I want to make sure we continue on that path, but I just realized that maybe some parents don't know what the marshmallow test is. Can we just give a quick definition of what or description of what that task was and what it meant when children would wait longer, just in terms of their future and all that?
In the marshmallow test, children are presented with a small treat, such as one marshmallow, and a larger treat, such as two marshmallows. And they're told that if you wait until I come back, you know, I have to leave the room to go do some work, if you wait until I come back and don't touch the treats, then you can have the larger treat. You can have the two marshmallows. But if you don't want to wait, that's okay. You can ring this bell and there's like a little hotel style bell or something. And then I'll come back. But then in that case, you can only have the one marshmallow. And so first you make sure that kids actually want the larger reward, which they do pretty invariably. And you make sure that they understand the rules. You make sure they understand that it's voluntary. It's kind of like, if you want to, when you want to, you can ring this bell and I'll come back, but then you only get the one. So we make sure they understand all of that. And then we measure just how long in seconds or minutes, you know, they delay. In my research, we've looked at up to 20 minutes,
wow,
which is a long, long time.
That's long.
But
how old are the kids?
They will range in age from, you know, in this work that we reported, they were all preschool age kids. So, okay. So this was, typically a 10 minute delay. And, this is identical to a procedure that Professor Walter Mischel had used in the 1960s from Stanford University. And we found that just the average, period of delay in that age group increased by 1 minute for kind of every 20 years or so when we compared the data.
And what do studies suggest, you know, if a child is able to wait longer, what does that mean for their future in terms of perhaps academic performance?
Well, it turns out that waiting longer delay of gratification is related to a host of concurrent things in their lives. Mm-hmm. So it does tend to be related to academic achievement, IQ and socioeconomic status of the family. And then it predicts things like, SAT scores and, emotion regulation, reduced drug use, increased income, in midlife. And many of those predictions hold up even when we control for their childhood IQ and socioeconomic status.
Wow. I know lots of parents are going to try this test at home this week after listening to this. I want to go back now to what you were talking about. And I think I want to define this a little bit more. When we talk about holding one instruction or one item in their head versus multiple for kids in elementary school, you know, I think about parents who struggle a lot with the morning routine or nighttime routine, especially when there's, you know, you come back from school and there's a sport and you need to get ready, get your soccer bag and your shoes and whatever it is. I feel that parents struggle a lot there because their kids will, you know, have difficulties with remembering what's next or what I need to do or what I need to plan. Is that what you mean when you talk about one versus multiple things and holding that in their heads?
That's right. So thinking about the steps in a plan or in a sequence of things. You know, you can't always skip to the end. You have to sometimes, you know, do some of the intermediate steps and being able to hold those in mind. Being able to plan backward from a deadline or a due date. So for an assignment in school, it sounds like if it's due in 2 weeks, it sounds like, well, that's forever. I've got a really long time to work on that. But one thing that we try to teach kids is to start to think of, to actually map out those 2 weeks and like start working backward from a deadline. Again, they tend to be pretty present focused. And so, you know, getting them to imagine their future selves and think about the self, you know, farther out into the distant future is a really good strategy for helping them see the present moment as a little bit less enticing, a little bit less salient and tempting than it is right now. Like to play this video game right now is super tempting and very salient. But if you start, and that's kind of, if you're just thinking about the present self, that looms really large. But if you can help kids start to think about the future self and imagine, you know, what it'll feel like to turn in that assignment on time, for example, then you create a little competition between the present self and the future self, and they can start to imagine that longer term consequence and, right. you know, the benefits of foregoing something now for the longer term future.
Right. Can you do that with a child, or can you have this discussion with a child who's in early elementary school, first, second cycle, grade one to grade four?
Absolutely. Even younger.
Wow.
And, and play is a really great way to do this, especially pretend play with young kids. So we've actually been researching this in our lab recently with four-year-olds, where we help them imagine their future selves using, just using a storyboard, you know, the kind of thing where mm-hmm. it's covered in felt and you can put like little felt figures on it, low tech. and they love it. And what we're asking them to do is save for the future. And four-year-olds and many 40-year-olds are like miserable at saving for the future. and so we put them in a situation where they have only three marbles, and they can play this marble shoot game. And they're going to play a small one. And then they're going to go play a really big one. But if they don't save any marbles for the big one, they're out of luck, right? Mm. If they spend all their marbles on that first game. Most four-year-olds spend all their marbles on the first game. but what we did is some of them were randomly assigned to imagine their future self before they did it. And imagine if you do save, you know, a marble for the big game, how will you feel? And we also tried, if you don't save, we had them imagine if you don't save a marble, and then you get to the big game and you don't have any, how will you feel? And, we found that, compared to a control condition where they just imagined like their bedtime routine, that night. So they're still imagining things and so forth, but it's not about the marble game. We found that, if they imagine saving, and how good they'll feel, they were significantly more likely to save at least one marble for the future. And, and interestingly, when they imagine not saving and how bad they would feel, it didn't help, not to the same degree. And right. so I think that is really interesting because my intuition as a parent, and you know, in talking to a lot of parents over the years, is that parents actually try to motivate kids by telling them how bad they should feel.
Right. I was going to say that. Yeah. With school, right? Like we say, like, what if you fail, or what if you don't make it, or what if you don't graduate? We do focus on that.
Yeah. And I really think that this research, and, you know, we have a lot more to do, to better understand this, but I think it's really suggestive that helping kids imagine positive outcomes is going to be more effective.
Mm. I love this so much. Wow. I know that this is, I know that this kind of information is really empowering to parents because it's something that we can do with our kids. With the example that you just described, I think about video games or screen time at home, where sometimes things are out of control and you're trying to find a way to regulate that and to have some sort of system. I would assume that we could apply the same thing in terms of having, I don't know, three coins that are 20 minutes each or, you know, 15 minutes each, and telling the child, if you use them all this morning, then you're done with your screen time for the day, versus if you kind of disperse it throughout the day. I don't know. I'm just thinking about this on the fly, but I feel that this would be a good way to get that child to realize, well, if I want to play before dinner time, I need to save that 20 minute coin.
Yeah. I love that idea.
Right. Yeah, I think we can do this in so many ways. I love this. So I know that parents listening now are thinking, great, that's one way. How else, like, is this a skill that they will eventually learn because of things that are happening to them around, you know, in their life and in their environment at preschool and at home, and that I'm just waiting for them to be in elementary school so that they are able to have, you know, like, or hold certain amounts of, you know, instructions and rules? Or do I have to do certain things at home? You know, there was a study that I was reading of yours that talks about the importance of that caregiver and the role that they have in scaffolding and building these executive function skills. So I know that the answer is yes, but I know that parents don't know how. So how about we kind of give them, you spoke about play. Are there other things that we need to be mindful of as we're parenting very young kids?
Absolutely. So executive function skills are first and foremost malleable So it's not like a blueprint or something that's sort of predestined, that if you just kind of like give your child food and water and sleep, that they'll just spontaneously develop these executive function skills. No, they really do depend on you and your support. They depend a lot on language development. And I do just want to make sure to mention that, because talking to your child, talking with your child, and helping to develop what we call self-speech. So helping them learn to talk to themselves and learn to talk themselves through their own problems, through their own challenging situations, is really important. And so, you know, language input in the home and modeling that, you know, even sort of modeling, talking to yourself sometimes is actually, you know, a really good thing. But in addition to that, with that kind of background, I want to mention that, you know, if you see your child struggling to do maybe a new task or to solve a new problem, you have basically three options. So you can let them struggle. So you can kind of sit back and think, well, you know, how are they going to learn if I, you know, so they need to just kind of work it out for themselves.
Figure it out, yeah.
Or they could do it for them. So, you know, oh, I don't want to see my child struggle. This is probably going to be too hard for them. I should do it for them. Or this is going to probably take a really long time and I don't have a lot of time. So I'm going to do it for them. Right. And we're all guilty
of tie their shoes.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, we've all done it.
we're all guilty of that. Yes. But there's a third way, kind of a middle way, which is to support the child's autonomy, to be autonomy supportive. And so what that means is to provide kind of just enough support so that your child can do it on their own or figure it out on their own, but they can't do it without you. So just letting them flail isn't going to do it. But they're also not going to learn how to do it or internalize that skill if you're always doing it for them. So being autonomy supportive means providing some scaffolding. You mentioned that word, and that means kind of like structuring tasks to be appropriately challenging. It means giving hints without actually directly telling them the answer or how to do it. It means following your child's pace. So, you know, not being impatient with them. You have to remember that kids' speed of processing just neurologically is way slower than ours. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's just a matter of allowing more time for them to think, you know, through these things. So allowing them that
which
time,
is also hard as a parent sometimes.
For sure.
Yeah.
And then lastly, offering choices. So instead of saying, oh, like let's say they're solving a puzzle together, instead of saying, oh, the red one goes there, it would be, I wonder which one fits there. Could it be the red one or the blue one? Right. And so you're directing their attention. And sometimes if it's, you know, depending upon the age, but if it's a puzzle with a lot of pieces, it's really overwhelming. Right. Mm-hmm. So things like, you know, oh, let's try to find edge pieces, or, you know, giving them that choice, is really helpful for kids, because what happens when you offer a child a choice and they make one, then suddenly they kind of own it, right? So it's a way for them to express their agency, you know, their autonomy. And it doesn't mean that they're, you know, independent or that they don't need you anymore or anything like that. We're not, you know, it just means that you're helping them to internalize these skills. And that's really what we want for our kids, you know, around the world. What parents want is for kids to be able to exhibit the skills and values that are prized in that family or in that society. They want kids to internalize them so that they do the right thing, whatever it is, when no one's looking.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's so true. I do think that this autonomy and being able to do something on their own is something so important for us as parents as well. But I think it's so hard. Like everything that you just described, I know that parents struggle with this because there's always this time factor that's kind of getting, you know, that's reminding us like I can't be late for work. And if your child wants to tie their shoes, it's just not the right time. Or you're, you know, doing a puzzle with your child or using building blocks. And I know that parents often feel like there's, you know, you have to go make dinner or it's almost bedtime. Even with homework, I think that parents really struggle because, you know, you have a certain amount of time and you don't want homework to, you know, be too long. You have to get ready for bed. So it's so hard for parents. But I think what you just said is a reminder that time helps build these skills that in the long run will be really impactful, you know, for a child's life. So I think it's really important that we hear this because we do tend to move things forward a little bit quickly.
Well, offering choices is a way to save time also.
That's true.
So offering a limited set of options reduces the problem space for the child, and it just literally speeds things up because now,
right.
you know, and then of course it's not like anything goes. Right. You know, they have to be sort of choice, you know, within reason.
Right. You had mentioned something, and I've been hearing a lot about sleep lately, and I just want to touch on that if we can, because, you know, even my friend, you know, right after the holidays sent me a message and said, we need to sleep more. You know, apparently, I don't know, there's a lot of talk now about sleep, but sleep also has an impact on, or not an impact, but there's a role of sleep and executive functions. What is it? And again, thinking of the parent right now who's listening to this, what do we need to be aware of within our homes?
Yeah, thank you for raising that. Sleep is so incredibly important, and it's amazing that we're still learning so much about the benefits of sleep and kind of how it works. And I've conducted some research on this with my colleague Annie Bernier and Julie Carrier, and we've looked at infant sleep and how it would then later predict within those same kids they're developing executive function skills. Mm-hmm. And so the infants were about 12 to 14 months at time one, and then we followed them up at time two. And in fact, Annie Bernier is still at University of Montreal is still following this sample, I believe. So, but it was interesting that it wasn't the total amount of sleep per day that predicted later executive function skills. It was sleep consolidation. So having,
what does this mean for parents?
Yeah. Sleep consolidation means having fewer disruptions of sleep.
Got it.
Fewer wakings within a sleep period. And, so we gave them, these little monitors on to put on their legs or on their wrists while they were sleeping, so we could see exactly how much they were, you know, awake or asleep. This probably, especially at that age, mostly has to do with brain development and with the development of these neural structures and circuits that do develop into prefrontal cortex development. And prefrontal cortex, as we know, is really important. The sort of frontmost part of your brain is really important for executive function skills. So, so there's definitely, psychophysiological story, behind the relation between sleep and executive function. But you know, there can be just long-term accrual, of sleep deficits, at any age. And those, very likely, impact our executive function skills. And executive function skills are sort of evolutionarily the most expendable. So, you know, so breathing is is going to be a pretty important function. Right. That, you know, you really can't survive very long without that. Right. And so breathing is sort of highly conserved, it's called. Mm-hmm. But executive function skills are a little bit more of a bonus in terms of, you know, evolution. And so, when we're severely sleep deprived, they can be the first thing to go.
And now parents, especially with young kids, are saying, well, that's why I forget and tend to struggle, right? It's not that mom brain thing. It's a human brain with lack of sleep thing.
Exactly.
Right. Oh, now I know you mentioned the consolidation piece in terms of sleep and infants, but I know even with myself, I have three kids, they're 4, 6, and 8 now. And I'm thinking of that first year and even up to the first year and a half, almost 2 years, sleep was very difficult. You know, they are very close in age. So there was always a newborn in the home. Their sleeping patterns were off. Does that mean with what you're seeing with research that we should be placing a lot of focus on, I don't know if I want to say the word sleep training, but, you know, helping them sleep longer periods of time if they are waking up multiple times throughout the night?
I think, yeah, whatever we can do kind of to arrange the environment to be most conducive to longer periods of uninterrupted sleep. But I know that that's easier said than done.
It's so hard, right? I'm going to dig into that research a little bit more and try to find studies that I could, you know, share with parents, because I do know that that's a very common question. And when it comes to sleep, I get lots of questions around sleep and attachment or sleep and brain functioning. And it's something that I can't answer. And I haven't found enough to kind of give a big summary about it. Like, it's hard to cover that. So I will look into that, because I think it's important to think about that with executive function skills. I just want to make sure that we have time to move on to parents a little bit, because there was this really interesting post online that showed, you know, a parent, a home, and items on the staircase, and, you know, struggling to make it on time to soccer, you know, practices. And they were saying it's not about the child, it's the parent. It's clearly a parent who's struggling with executive function skills. And I thought it was interesting to see it that way. And even if I think about myself and my partner, you know, I do see some, you know, struggles with executive functions as well. And I think we're not alone. And I think there are, you know, neurodivergent parents as well who know that they are struggling with this. So you said that it's malleable, right? It's not something that we're, if we have a certain amount of skills around this, that we're stuck with that. So we can definitely change. So it's never too late. You're telling me if I'm in my 40s, I'm still okay.
Yes. So I think one of the things that we've noticed in the last few years is that executive function, the term executive function, is becoming kind of more commonly known. And I'm seeing more of a shift also to adults in audiences that I speak with, for example. They're, you know, coming up to me afterward and saying, you know, oh my gosh, you know, I struggle with this, or you know, my staff struggles with this, or my partner struggles with this. This isn't just, you know, an issue in kids. And so, you know, although on average we see that developmental pattern that I told you about, you know, executive function skills kind of peak around one's mid-20s, there are individual differences at any age. So I think that's really important to keep in mind. And I am turning now, given, you know, just so many people mentioning that to me, it literally led me to co-found a company on executive function skills for adults. And we had already co-founded a company, Phil Zelazo and I, for executive function skills for kids, so measurement and development of executive function skills, called Reflection Sciences. And then we more recently co-founded with a partner of ours, Reflective Performance, and that is designed to both measure and address executive function skills for the adult workforce. So I think a lot of these issues that come up in the workplace, and, you know, or just trying to manage a home, are you know, very traceable to executive mm-hmm. function issues, even though in the past, adults might not have known that label or, you know, thought to label them that way. So issues with time management, being, you know, tardy or absent, being rude to a customer, if you're in customer mm-hmm. service, having, you know, sort of underperforming, at work or having low productivity, a lot of, you know, again, that difficulty with time management. A lot of these issues are traceable to executive function skills that can be improved and can be developed. And so I'm excited about this kind of relatively new awareness of executive function in adults and its importance in the workforce.
Right, because everything that you mentioned in terms of in schools, you know, with children and planning and, you know, creating, thinking about the future self and how it will feel to give in that project, I was thinking of parents and adults at the workplace. And I think it's the same thing, you know, and lots of parents feel that, you know, we can do things at the last minute, but sometimes it's that we haven't planned properly. And it's not just about not having the time, it's not managing that time properly. Same thing with a household. I think that it's very, you know, I hear a lot of parents talk about balancing work and life. And I feel that it's not about just balance. I don't know if there is such a thing as like the perfect balance, but I do know that with planning, I see it with myself as well. Like the more I plan, the better that week is, right? So the more I kind of get into that week and know exactly when do I need to do this? When does that need to get done? You know, when do I have this meeting and working around everything? I just feel better about that week. And then I'm able to have a more successful week. I don't know if that's balancing everything necessarily. There might be weeks where you work a lot more because of deadlines. And there might be weeks where you spend a lot more time with your kids. But in general, it's truly the planning piece that makes a big difference.
I think so. And it's, again, easier said than done.
Right.
And yeah. But a lot of the same techniques that and strategies that we would advise for kids are applicable to adults as well. So engaging in that future self thinking, for example, and how good it will feel to, you know, kind of have things under control next week. And there are a few sort of principles and best practices about how to cultivate executive function skills in kids that would apply to adults as well. So some of those, if I may, are continuing to stretch yourself. So executive function skills, by definition, are kind of activated and exercised and strengthened only when we're using them. And when things are easy and familiar, then we're on autopilot and we're not exercising those executive function skills. So one piece of advice is to stretch yourself. So put yourself in some new situations. Try doing things a little bit differently. Brush your teeth with your non-dominant hand.
Right.
You know, things like that. So keeping the challenge level up. And then also this choice piece is really important, I think, and our data back that up in kids, that it's really the offering kids choices that is most strongly related to their executive function skills. And so, you know, if you're an employer or a parent, you know, offering choice so that then employees or kids take ownership over their decision. Right. And it helps them assess kind of the fit for, you know, for the task, between their abilities and the task at hand. And then also keeping it joyful. So, you know, as much as you possibly can, positive emotion, positive affect, you know, this sort of dopamine rush that occurs when, things are joyful, is related to improved executive function skills. And it allows you to kind of like see those options that are in front of you. It's almost never the case that you really only have one response at your disposal. And so being able to be expansive in your thinking and not be either or in your thinking, to start to think about, wait, I have more than one option here about how to handle this situation or how to solve this problem, is really liberating. And then the last thing is to practice these skills, in multiple contexts. So, that's how we get transfer of skills from one domain to another, is to practice them in multiple contexts. And that's kind of in general, some of the principles and best practices that can apply across. And then I have one more suggestion, which is an acronym called STAR. So, if you just kind of find yourself wanting to respond one way or react one way to a situation or to solve something, like you're like that infant or toddler who is stuck on kind of with that one thing in mind or that one solution, and you can't like get unstuck and think about things a different way, is to use this STAR method. And I'm like kind of looking for feedback on this too, so I don't know how it's going to resonate with people, but I was thinking about this, and I think, so S is like stop. So, first introducing a pause in your stream of action, right? And then the T is think. So like think twice about things before, just acting on impulse or on habit. And then act. So you thought about what your options are. You choose an option and you act, you execute it. And then the R is for reflect. So, I paused, I thought, considered my options, I chose a course of action, and now you reflect and you say, okay, how did that go? What would I do differently next time? Things like that. So reflection is really the key ingredient in how we can transform ourselves from being, kind of self-serving, impulsive, and unregulated beings to more regulated, other-serving, and kind of long-term thinking.
I completely agree. I think that is one of the things we talk about the most here at Curious Neuron as parents, and to give this kind of skill to your children, because parents will say things like, I went from 0 to 100, or I experienced rage in like a split second and I didn't see it coming. It was so fast, and I yell, and then I fall in this sort of cycle of feeling guilty, that I did that again with my child. And it's that, that lack of control and awareness of what's happening. But I just recently put out this 100-page workbook for parents, but like it's a bunch of reflection questions for different situations, because I just want parents to be able to come back to certain events and to think back at what were you thinking in that moment? What happened before? Because sometimes we don't piece things together. And I've talked about this often here on the podcast, where after having my third child, I was not myself around 4 p.m. And it took a lot of time and reflection to kind of realize that the amount of noise of being home with three very small kids, three kids under the age of four, by four-ish, o'clock, that's when I was done. There was too much sound. There was too much movement, and I needed to step away a bit. So I brought in a lot of these sort of calming activities around that time. Let's play with Play-Doh. Let's turn the TV off. Let's change the environment. So that's when I learned the power of that reflection piece is so important. I'm going to put the link to your TEDx talk and to your studies. But I really encourage parents to go watch your TEDx talk, because you had this image of a tree, and at the bottom of this tree, so you talked about social emotional skills, I believe, in academic performance, right? And you think of that being the tree, and then comes the trunk, and then the roots. At the bottom of the roots is the reflection piece. And I'm not doing a good job at summarizing it, but basically, I think there's so much talk around academic performance and making sure that our kids do well. I personally, because of my own research with emotions, feel that we should be talking a lot more about, emotion regulation skills and social emotional skills, because that makes a big difference in their future as well. but you bring everything together with that executive function piece and talking about reflection. Can you just maybe give a quick summary so that we could end the conversation around here? But, you know, why is the reflection piece so important, not just for us as parents, but to model this and teach this to our kids?
Well, thank you. You did an excellent job of summarizing it. But so the idea is that executive function skills are strongly related to academic skills as well as social and emotional skills. So we talked about the connection to social and emotional skills, but really, you know, there's quite a bit of evidence that it predicts academic achievement, because of that cognitive piece. It's so important. Right. And so we know that success, and, you know, there's lots of different ways of thinking about success and defining success, but it's going to depend on both of these sort of cognitive and traditionally academic skills, as well as social and emotional skills and well-being. And so I view executive function skills as the root of, in this tree of success, which has the two branches of academic and social and emotional. And like a tree and how it grows, it depends a lot on the environment. So, if there are pests in the roots that are, you know, contributing to sort of toxic soil,
right,
then, you know, the executive function, the tree is not going to be healthy, and executive function can't kind of do its job. And, you know, there are other kind of environmental influences that I talk about as well. But I also mentioned that the kind of taproot of this tree is reflection. And so at some level, executive function skills, being able to hold things in mind, to set goals and pursue them through challenges, requires this ability to pause and to consider one's actions and before acting, and then also to then reconsider them after acting, so that we can better adapt to challenges and changes in the environment. And reflection is hard to grasp, and it's hard for me to kind of to get my arms around, because it's not as easy to measure as executive function skills are. But I do view reflection as a bit of like sort of the ghost in the machine. but again, you know, language, warmth from caregivers, opportunities, play, all of these things are really important for the development of this tree of success.
I wanted to make sure, maybe a parent also has a question about, like, how do you measure this? Like, what happens in the lab? How are executive functions measured?
Yes. So we measure executive function skills all day long. So we really have benefited from the century or more of research in cognitive science and in looking at neurocognitive development. So, you know, we have known for some time that prefrontal cortex is really important for these skills. And we have known for some time that when, if you have an adult who has a stroke, for example, and there's a lesion then in the prefrontal cortex, that there are ways in which they might begin to show some deficits that are not unlike how a typical three-year-old is in some ways, and, you know, getting stuck on problems, for example.
Right.
And so we've really benefited from all of that research, Alexander Luria, for example, and have part of my job as a developmental psychologist has been to take those measures and make them work for young kids, make them kind of reverse engineer them so that we can start to look at how those skills develop in the first place, not just what happens when there's an accident or a lesion or, you know, some kind of injury. So we have developed a measure called the Minnesota Executive Function Scale, and it's validated down to 2 years of age, you know, and then all the way up through the lifespan, and it's normed on over 50,000 kids in the United States. We need to develop Canadian norms, but and you know, we have over 175,000 assessments now, and this is, you know, provided by Reflection Sciences, the company that I mentioned to you. And so we're using this tool now to get a better and more and more accurate understanding of what to expect when. And we talked at the beginning about how important expectations are. And so educators are using the tool in addition to researchers now to kind of be able to measure, for example, the improvements with a social emotional skills program. You know, how do you measure those improvements and kind of the foundational skills of executive function? So those tools are available now.
I'm going to make sure that I add all these links. So if there's a company that's interested in, do you train the companies? Let's say if there's a leader or they want to work with their team, is this something that they can contact you for within your company?
Yeah, absolutely. So so. On the adult workforce side of things, again, we've been looking at how executive function skills predict which trainees will complete a hiring or training program and which ones are still on the job 6 months later, and using data analytics to look at employee fit and so forth. So, and that's reflective performance. We'd love to talk with anyone who's interested.
Perfect. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today. I enjoyed this conversation, and I told you at the beginning I'd have a lot of difficulty keeping it short. Your work is so interesting. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me.